Morning, hope you're doing all right. Good. So I'm allowed water in here. I just want to make that clear that you can watch me drink. good to be with you this weekend as we think through this issue. I've had a quick peek at some of the questions. Thank you so much for sending those through. Many of them are very heartfelt, very thoughtful, very searching. So I hope we will have a good amount of time to look at those. Random question, and I'm asking obviously for a friend. If someone was to go down to the harbour and extract tea from it, would that reverse the Declaration of Independence? I've got a bit of time this afternoon, I'm just trying to work out what to do with it. Last night I wanted to spend time thinking through both the kind of Christian sexual ethic as we hear it from Jesus himself, and also to try to, I guess, counterbalance that with what Paul says about the goodness of singleness. I was aware we got into some pretty heavy issues last night, and obviously this whole topic, we're on sensitive ground for many of us anyway. What I want to do this morning is, in this first session, to think through the issue of intimacy. I'm sure for many of us, the thing we most fear about singleness is that it will mean a lack of intimacy. We fear loneliness. We fear isolation. There are many other challenges and disciplines we need to think through with singleness. We need to think through how we flee from sexual temptation, how we try and remain holy and live for Christ in that kind of way. But I think the deeper fear for many of us is that it will be profoundly isolating. A friend of mine who lives on the other coast, and so I hardly get to see him, but I remember him. He's I guess around 30 years old. He is same-sex attracted, and he wrote to me one day, and he was needing to buy a new car. And as he was buying a car, I don't know why this was the particular moment where it all hit him, but that's just the way life sometimes is. As he was buying a car, the dealer, whoever, was saying to him, what kind of vehicle will you need? Are you looking for, you know, lots of seats in the back and that kind of stuff? And it suddenly hit this guy, no, I won't need a car with lots of seats in the back. And it just sort of hit him viscerally that he wasn't likely to have kids. He wasn't likely to be a dad with all the kind of munchkins sat in the back. And I remember him writing to me and saying, I can't imagine the shell of a life that I'm going to be living as someone who is single. And it's a, you know, you get an email like that and you become very conscious of the distance between you and the friend. I would love to have just gone round to his house immediately just to sort of spend some time with him. But that is the fear many of us will have if we're wondering whether singleness might be something long term. Someone else said it in these terms. They said, I feel doomed to singleness. Doomed to it. It is up there with that level of fear. So I want us to think through this issue of perceived feared lack of intimacy. The wonderful theologian Leslie Knope, if you're familiar with the book of Parks and Rec, she once said that every time a couple gets married, two single people die. In that particular episode, her best friend, it looked like she was going to be getting together with someone, and she was already in anticipation mourning the loss of two people who were her friends who were now going to sort of emigrate to coupledom and never be seen again. That is a fear many of us have who are single, by the way, isn't it? I remember a friend of mine met a girl, got engaged, got married all pretty quickly, and me and his other friends, the moment he got engaged, we never saw him again. We got invited to the wedding. We had a kind of, what do you call it, a stag night for him? Do you call it that here? Bachelor party. That makes more sense, doesn't it? But that was it. And I remember kind of, I saw him a few years later, and he was saying how much he regretted not having invested more in friendship in his early years of marriage. He was feeling the pain of that. But for a while, we called him Frodo, because the moment the ring went on his finger, he disappeared. And there's a fear for those of us who are single, particularly when you go through your late 20s, early 30s, a lot of your friends are getting married. The fear is, we'll just be left here on our own. Everyone else will have gone into marriage land, and we will be the only ones who are left. So the choice between marriage and singleness shouldn't be the choice between marriage and loneliness. Not if we're reading our Bibles rightly and living the Christian life rightly. So I want us to think a little bit about what the Bible says about intimacy and some of the ways the Bible commends intimacy to us that has nothing to do with romance and sex and those kinds of things. In our culture, we have so collapsed sex and intimacy into one another that we really can't imagine one without the other. We can't conceive of any kind of intimacy that isn't ultimately to do with sex. We just don't have a category for that. When we had the centenary of the end of the First World War, no, we haven't had that yet, have we? Have we? Yes, we have. For a moment then, I just completely forgot what year this is. It's Saturday morning. My brain isn't used to having to work on a Saturday morning. But when we had the centenary of the kind of end of the First World War, one of the things that happened in the UK was that the BBC radio started to play people reading extracts of diaries of soldiers who had been in the trenches. And it was the most amazing way of just getting a snapshot into the kind of ordinary life of a typical soldier. And what was interesting was they'd then have a few people kind of discussing what the diary had said and reflecting on it. And in one of these things, one of the diaries spoke really movingly of the depth of friendship this particular soldier had with one of the other guys he was in the trenches with. And the people who were then commenting on it were kind of like, well, you know, they were obviously gay then, but too suppressed to be able to acknowledge that or admit it. And I remember thinking that's so typical of us, that the moment any kind of closeness is evidence, we immediately assume it must be really to do about sex. And we kind of roll our 21st century eyes and go, well, they were obviously gay. Because in our culture, we've got no other way of accounting for depth of friendship other than it's sexual. That says far more about us than it says about those troops. That's a very recent way to think. It's a very Western way to think. And it's not a biblical way to think. So here's the thing. You can have lots and lots of sex and not be experiencing any intimacy. I know people for whom that is the case. Actually, we see that, I think, in the Bible. King David, you may remember in 2 Samuel chapter 1, is mourning the loss of his dear friend Jonathan. And he says at one point, as he's kind of lamenting the loss of Jonathan, he says, "Your love meant more to me than the love of a woman." And so, as you can imagine, you know, lots of writers today are going, "Ha ha, there we go. David was gay." But here's the thing. By this stage, David already had three wives. David had a really screwed up view of women. And so I suspect David didn't really know how to have intimacy. He knew how to have a lot of sex. And I wonder if what was so special and meaningful to him about his friendship with Jonathan was actually this was a relationship where there genuinely was intimacy, rather than just the exchange of bodily fluids. In the Bible, sex is given as a gift to express and deepen intimacy within marriage. It can't, abstract it from that context, create it. But many of us think, well, sex is the way into intimacy, so I just sleep around until I find intimacy. And if that's our attitude, we are going to be very easy to use. Because someone just has to sort of give a hint of being interested in intimacy, and too easily, they can find people to bed. So you can have lots and lots and lots of sex and no intimacy at all. It's a miserable way to live. But here's the other thing. You can have lots and lots and lots of intimacy that is nothing to do with sex. Now, in our culture, we have so downgraded friendship. We've turned friend from a noun into a verb. So you get a friend when what? You add someone on Facebook. You have your friendiversary on Facebook. And what it means is you gave that person access to your profile page. And in today's culture, hey presto, there is a friendship. That is what friendship is to so many people. It's defined by, I'll let you see my profile page. We will have all kinds of gossip magazines about which celebrities are hooking up with each other. We have no interest as a culture in which celebrities are friends with each other. Because friendship is just not significant. I remember hearing a talk by Tim Keller where he was talking about the Lord of the Rings movies, and he said the books of the Lord of the Rings are probably one of the most significant novels ever written about friendship. Very little romance in the Lord of the Rings books. There's a bit tucked away in the appendices, but the movie makers, having to appeal to us lot, take the sex out of the appendices and put it right there at the center of the plot line. Because we're not interested in friendship. We don't really have a place for it. It's there for when the person you are romantically involved with is busy one evening. That is not how the Bible sees friendship. And I want to commend the biblical view of friendship to you. Not because I think it's nice and helpful, though it is both of those things, but because the implication from the book of Proverbs is you can't be wise in God's world if you don't have friends. And by friends, we don't mean contacts on Facebook. So I want you to turn with me to a couple of verses in Proverbs that will just orient us to what Proverbs means by friendship, and I hope blow apart our own vision of what friendship is and what it can be. So we're going to start with Proverbs 18, verse 24. Proverbs is basically the biblical equivalent of Twitter. It's just lots of kind of short statement, only it's inspired and helpful. So if you want to take a Twitter fast, the best way of doing it is just reading Proverbs and pretending each verse is a tweet. Okay, if that helps you to read it, you can even put it on a screen and someone should do that. Someone should do an app that just sets out Proverbs as if you're reading through a Twitter feed. Someone go do that. That would be fun. So Proverbs 18, verse 24 says, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." So that proverb is distinguishing friendship from a couple of other types of relationship. It distinguishes friendship from companionship. A companion in this context is someone who is a familiar acquaintance, but the kind of familiar acquaintance that comes and goes. Think of, the people you were at high school with or at university with, or some of the colleagues you had in the job before the job you have now. People you kind of spent time with, enjoyed each other's company, but you didn't necessarily bring those friendships with you into your new situation of life, right? They were there for that season, but they weren't sort of deep relationships. And I was thinking about this and some of the people I was at high school with, and it's amazing how, again, there's a lot of shared experience you can have with people you study with or people that you work with without really knowing each other deep down. If you'd asked me or my friends at high school to tell stories about each other, we could give you hours and hours of stories of dumb things each other had done. But I couldn't tell you what their hopes and fears and dreams and anxieties were. We didn't know each other at that level. So it felt like there was a lot of familiarity, but actually there wasn't depth. By the way, that is the kind of thing Facebook gives us. It gives you a sense of being in contact, of keeping up with what other people are doing. It feels like on some level you are being relational when you're not. If you have 500 friends on Facebook, what you have 500 of is not actually friendship. It's this acquaintanceship thing, what this proverb is calling a companion. Someone who's you kind of hang around with for a season, but not a friendship you take with you for the rest of your life. So the friend is different to that kind of acquaintance. Notice too, the proverb is making a distinction between even a friend and a brother. Friendship is different in Proverbs to close family. It's not to say that there can't be friendship within family. It's not saying the two are incompatible, but there's something about friendship that is distinctive. With friendship, it is voluntary. You're friends with someone because you choose to be. You didn't have to be. Whereas there is a sense with our close family that there is an obligation. There should be an obligation. And so there is a distinction between friendship and family, although there can wonderfully be some overlap as well. So when the Bible is talking about friendship, it is not merely talking about the people you hang out with, nor is it talking about the people that you feel obligated to because you have the same last name and the same kind of blood flowing through your veins. It's a different kind of relationship to those two things. Let's have a look at another verse, Proverbs 17, verse 17. One of the great things about the book of Proverbs, by the way, is it feels very muddled to us because it's not like here are, 15 verses on friendship, then here are 15 verses on money, then here are 15 verses on work. It's all jumbled up, and I always used to wonder why that was. It would be much more systematic if it was, organized properly. Someone needs to get in there and tidy it up. But then, actually, the point of Proverbs is it's trying to give you wisdom for real life. And on any given day of your life, you need a bit of wisdom on friendship, a bit of wisdom on what to do with your money, a bit of wisdom on how to use your time. You don't need all the wisdom there is on one day for friendship, and then all the wisdom on another day for work and so on. So it's actually really good that it is jumbled up. So just read a chapter of Proverbs a day, and you'll have bits of wisdom for the things that you will encounter in that day. So Proverbs 17, verse 17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. So a feature of friendship in the Bible is constancy. Now, a brother is born for adversity, which I think is saying when there's a crisis, that is when family really kicks in. When there's some kind of emergency, that's when you show up and are there for each other as family. That's what you do as family. But a friend loves at all times. In other words, the friend is there when there's not an emergency, when the chips aren't down. The friend is there for you at all times, in all the seasons of your life, in the downs and the ups. And so there's a sense in which the friend sees the most rounded version of you because they see you at all times. They see you on your bad days. They see you on your good days. They see you when you're losing. They see you when you're winning. They have a fuller view of you often than your own family does. Or Proverbs chapter 19, verse 4. Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend. The real friend is there for you when you've lost everything else. There's a lot of fake friends around the moment you're doing really well. You get the promotion, you get the amazing jobs, you suddenly find yourself wealthy. You'll have a ton of people wanting to be your friend, claiming to be your friend. When you lose it all, the people who are still around, those are the ones who actually were your friends the whole time. In other words, real friendship isn't transactional. Some people are acting like friends to you because they see a use in you for them. You are a value to them in some way. But the real friend is there for you in all seasons. And final one on these, Proverbs 27 and verse 9. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, apparently. I'll take your word for it on that. And the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. So inasmuch as oil and perfume are pleasing, and they are, I travel a lot, and so I have one of those things at home, like a reed diffuser thing. Is that what you guys call them here? It's got smelly oil in the bottom, and you stick some sticks in it, and it makes a nice smell. What do you call those? Diffuser. It is called a diffuser. I never quite know with you guys what you call things. And so when if I go away for a week or two and I come back, the house can smell a bit stuffy and all this. So I have a couple of those things. It's nice just walking in, and there's a kind of a nice smell when you walk through the door. It's kind of like, that's nice. And the proverb is saying, hey, as much as that is nice, even sweeter than that, even more pleasurable than that, is a friend who gives you earnest counsel. The words for earnest counsel literally mean the counsel of his soul. That is, it's not talking about the friend who gives you kind of superficial advice, but the person who talks to you about things really from the heart, who is counseling you from the depths of who they are. In other words, that the sweetness of the friendship lies in the fact that it is a soul-to-soul relationship. This person knows you at that kind of level. That is true, even if their counsel is challenging you and trying to correct you. It's just good to have someone who knows your soul and deeply cares for it. In Hebrew, people who speak Hebrew know this. I don't, but they tell me this. So unless there's a massive conspiracy among all of them, this is true. Friendship in Hebrew can also mean secret. Because the friend is the person you tell your secrets to. The friend is the person you trust with that kind of stuff. That's the person you really do spill the beans with. And so in Proverbs, friendship is not this superficial, we've got a shared interest, or we watch a sports match together, or we just hang out and have a laugh. Friendship is someone who really does know what is going on in your life and sticks around. That is intimacy. Intimacy is being deeply known and deeply loved at the same time. That is what we were made for. And according to Proverbs, we find that in friendship. And in case we're tempted to think, maybe that's just a sort of Old Testament thing, and maybe that doesn't apply in the same way or something, here's Jesus on friendship. This is amazing, this verse. This is in my list of things I would never, ever remotely believe to be true were it not in the Bible. Just listen to this verse. This is John 15, verse 15. Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, "No longer do I call you servants." Now, he's not saying there's no element of service in our relationship to Jesus. Obviously, there is, but he's saying that is not the primary category now in which he places us. He says, "No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master's doing. If you are merely a servant, then you don't need to know what's going on. You just need to know what you've been told to do and to do it." Jesus says, "I no longer call you servants, but I've called you friends." Jesus calls his disciples friends. And he tells us why. He says, "I've called you friends for..." Now, here's the amazing thing. Whatever Jesus says next is going to show us what Jesus believes friendship to consist of. What is defining for Jesus of a friend rather than a servant. He says, I have called you friends for I added you on Facebook. We hung out that one time and it was fun. No, I've called you friends for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Friendship for Jesus is letting someone in on what's really going on. Jesus says what makes us his friends is that he shared everything he's heard from the Father with us. He's not kept us at a distance. He's invited us in, and he's invited us the whole way in. He's told us everything that's going on. And for Jesus, that makes us friends with him. So the question is, who knows you well enough to know how you really are? Who knows you well enough that they don't necessarily need to talk to you to have a sense of how they most need to pray for you just because they know what's going on in your life? Who's got that kind of read on you? Who gets a sense of how your soul is? Who knows what keeps you up at night? Who knows what gets you out of bed in the morning? Who knows your worst sins? That's a friend. If there isn't someone who's coming to mind now, you don't have real friends. And you need them. We all do. Hey, married people, you need friends too. I was preaching at my home church once on what Proverbs teaches on friendship, and when you get to know a congregation well enough, you can begin to sense what is going on in some people's heads even as you're speaking. I remember giving this sermon, and I could hear married people in the church thinking, oh, it's good for the single people to hear this stuff on friendship. And so I said, listen, if you are married, you need friends too. And if you don't have friends, your marriage is going to suffer for it. I've seen marriages implode precisely because they didn't have friends. They were trying to meet every emotional need each other had with just the two of them. We need friendships. So here's how this lands on me as a single person. There is a depth of intimacy that my married friends experience that I don't get to experience. That one particular person that you share that amount of life with. That's a depth of intimacy being unmarried, I don't know. But as a single person, there is a breadth of intimacy that I'm able to experience and enjoy that my married friends can't. I have the capacity and the time and the freedom to invest in a range of friendships that I wouldn't be able to invest in if I was married. I've got some very, very dear friends who are 20 years older than me. I've got some very dear friends that are, say, 15 years younger than me, and a good number who are about my age as well. And I love that. I love that range. And so, yeah, there's a depth that I miss out on when it comes to intimacy, but there's a breadth I get to have that I wouldn't have if I was married. Now, there's one more dimension to this I want to talk about before we head into our break. The Bible gives us, commends to us, urges upon us this category of friendship. Jesus himself speaks to it, and Jesus himself embodies it. He is the ultimate friend. But the other main category of intimacy the Bible gives us, and these two things overlap and interlock, is that we are meant in our local churches, we are meant to be a spiritual family. Now, we know that because we refer to the church family. That's one of our words for it. But the trouble is we use the language of family to describe our churches without necessarily checking to see if that is actually the reality of what our churches are like. One of my friends says, we call our church a family because it makes us sound friendly, not necessarily because our church is a family. But we are meant to be. I remember a well-meaning couple coming up to me at church one week, it was a few years ago now, and saying, we just want you to know we think of you as family. And I appreciated what they meant by that, but at the same time I was thinking in my head, well, you've never invited me on vacation. I don't have a key to your house. What they mean is we kind of like you. And that's nice, I'll take that. That's better than a kick in the teeth. But the word family actually means more than that. And it is what we are meant to be to each other within the fellowship of our churches. So let me take you to an amazing passage on this. It's Mark chapter 10. And then we'll run towards the nearest source of caffeine. Mark chapter 10, verses 28 to 30. This is a promise of Jesus that for some reason isn't really, really well known. But it needs to be. These words could totally transform your local church. We've just had the rich young man. He looked like he was, you know, prime discipleship material. He has this encounter with Jesus. He won't do what Jesus asks of him. And so he leaves the encounter disappointed. And we, as we read along, we feel disappointed too. I think, oh, he would have been great. This is so sad. And so in verse 28, Peter decides this is the moment to really highlight how amazing he is at being a disciple. Peter's the emotionally intelligent one who kind of thinks, you know, it hasn't worked out with that guy, but he says to Jesus, hey, we've left everything and followed you. And you can just sort of, you know, Jesus is I don't know how he's feeling about this guy who's just wandered off, but it's tragic. And Peter's effectively going, hey, Jesus, aren't you glad we're here? Yep, it didn't work out with that guy, but you've got your A team here right now. I mean, that would have been nice with him too, but you don't really need him when you've got us, do you? Jesus, You know, aren't you lucky to have us on board? You are very, very welcome. That's where Peter is going with this. Jesus, we're told in verse 28, Peter began to say this. Evidently, Jesus didn't let him get through all the stuff he had to say on this. In verse 29, Jesus says to him, truly I say to you, which is Jesus' way, I think, of saying, shut up. Okay? Idiotically, you're saying to me, so truly I'm going to say to you, okay? So listen to what Jesus says. He says, there is no one, no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive a hundredfold now, in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life. Jesus is assuming people will leave things to follow him. That is basic discipleship. You turn to Jesus, and that involves turning from some other things. Jesus is always upfront about that. It is going to be costly to follow him. There will be things that we leave behind. Moreover, Jesus is assuming the most costly things to leave will be familial and relational. There are some people for whom becoming a disciple of Jesus will mean they leave their homes and their kin. They do end up leaving their community. Now, mercifully, that is not the case for all of us, but it is the case for some people. We can think of believers who come from particular backgrounds, from particular communities, where the moment their faith in Christ goes live, they are not going to be welcomed back. They will lose their families. But notice, even looking at that level of cost, Jesus says it is going to be worth it. He doesn't look at the prospect of that kind of cost and say, yeah, man, that's just going to stink, but don't worry because at the end you get heaven. No, Jesus says even in this life, it will be worth it. We will receive in this life a hundredfold. Now, Jesus is not saying, hey, you leave a dollar, I'll give you a hundred. This isn't that kind of thing. He's not saying, hey, if you leave a house, I'll give you 100 houses. You will have this amazing property portfolio if you come and follow me. No, just as the cost was relational and familial, so too the blessing is that Jesus is promising here. He is promising us an abundance of spiritual family. Those who leave house, brothers, sisters, mother, father, children, lands will receive those very things in Jesus. Psalm 68 says that God sets the lonely in families. And that is what Jesus is promising to do here. And so those whose discipleship severs them from their community, from their homes, from their people, will be grafted in to a new people. They will receive a hundredfold. Now, it's easy to hear that promise and to go, oh, I like Jesus. He's so nice. Isn't that nice of Jesus to promise that? Now, it is, and we should worship him for it, but we also need to recognize we are meant to be the fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters that Jesus is promising. This promise depends on us to fulfill it. If we are not being the family to the people who otherwise would have no family, then we are making Jesus out to be a liar. So Jesus says they should be receiving a hundredfold now in this time, houses. Let me ask you, who else who doesn't have your last name has a key to your front door? Who else is your house being a fulfillment of this promise of Jesus to you? Who gets to call your house home because of the goodness of Jesus to them? Brothers, sisters, mothers, children, lands, who are you a spiritual parent to? Who is there coming, you know, along the journey of discipleship, maybe a bit behind you in terms of Christian experience, that you can think, do you know what, I would love to encourage that person in the faith as they kind of follow behind me in the path of discipleship. Who can I share the things that I've learned with, the mistakes I've made and had to learn the hard way from? Who can I help not do the same things? Or brothers and sisters, who are you linking arms with and doing life with? A friend of mine says there are catch up with friends and there are do life with friends. The catch up with friend is the kind of person who says, hey, I'd love to have you over and just hear how you're doing and you can hear how I'm doing and that'd be really nice, and then in 3 months' time we'll do the same thing. Now that's nice, I like that. But we also need to do life with friends, the people who you don't need to catch up with because you're already tracking with each other already. Who are you being that to? And who are you being a spiritual son or daughter to? Who is there older than you in the faith that you can be thinking, man, that person is going to know a whole ton of stuff that I don't know? And you can be an encouragement to them and learn from them. That is what church is meant to be. Paul calls it repeatedly the household of God, the family of God. When we refer to one another as brothers and sisters, that's not like an honorary thing, that's real. And the blood of Jesus is thicker than the blood of biology. And so the single person should be thinking, well, I'm not married. I don't have my own physical family. But because I'm in this church, whatever our church is, we should be able to say, do you know what? I have so much more family as a single person in Christ than I ever would have had as a married person outside of Christ. If someone can't say that, our churches are making Jesus out to be a liar. And so it is the responsibility of all of us in the local church if anyone is feeling isolated and lonely. Now, some people need more time to themselves, and there's personality types and different temperaments and all of that, and we respect that and we honor that. Some people want to be alone. No one should be lonely. And that's on us, the rest of us, if they are. I remember at my home church, there'd been a kind of succession of people who, in their 30s and 40s, had left the faith by getting into relationships with unbelievers that ended up drawing them out of church life. And I remember when one of these cases happened, a lady had moved in with a non-believing man and had stopped coming to church. I remember some of the folks in church kind of tutting and clucking about the whole thing and kind of going, oh, it's terrible what she's done. And I remember thinking, yeah, I think it is terrible what she's done. But here's the question, did we give her an alternative? How much of that is on us? One writer said there's a parallel with food. If your only apparent choices in life were starving or eating really kind of crappy junk food, however much you don't like, and you know, you see the lack of nutrition in junk food, if that's all there is, other than starvation, you'll eat it, because you've got to eat something. And the point applies to intimacy. If the only apparent options to you are no intimacy, or intimacy through an unbiblical form of relationship, you are likely to take the illicit intimacy rather than the lack of intimacy. Which is why our churches, if we're going to uphold the Bible's teaching on sexual ethics, we have to provide godly, healthy intimacy. Otherwise, I think we share the responsibility when people leave the faith. That is on us. And yes, it's the kind of thing it's good for pastors to be aware of, and it's good to be on their radar, but it's not the kind of thing where we should be saying, yes, the church needs to program that in and do something. We need to do something. If we're not opening our homes and lives to one another, we're part of the problem. But the danger is, and our culture trains us to think this way, we think, well, as long as I'm sorted out, and as long as I've got my family unit, then I'm okay, and again, I pull up the drawbridge and I keep everybody else out, and I protect it. Whereas I think we're meant to be sharing it and drawing others into it. That is what hospitality is in the Bible. It's not entertaining. It's opening our lives to other people, and there's a way to do that that's appropriate, and we've got to be careful, of course. But the single people should not feel as though there is a lack of intimacy. Not if we're being church in the way that we're meant to be. If the church is simply the assembly of distinct family units, we've got a problem. We're meant to be brothers and sisters, mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters to one another.